welcome to the interview with Alternatives Magazine. Today
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and we have Dr. Stephen Gagos with us, who is one of the world's foremost experts on the use of deep imagery. He developed the personal totem pole process that combines Jungian thought with Eastern and Native American traditions. He is author of several books, including Into Wholeness, The Path of Deep Imagery, The Personal Totem Pole, Animal Imagery, The Chakras, and Psychotherapy, and The Animals of the Four Windows, Integrating Thinking, Sensing, Feeling, and Imagery, and also Little Ed and the Golden Bear. He's offered workshops worldwide and has trained therapists and many other individuals in this unique form of deep imagery. So, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. So the first thing I'd like to ask you, and this is for people who are unfamiliar with the personal totem pole process, if you could give us an overview of what this is.
It began actually about 30 years ago when my animals came to me out of my own chakras. That is, watching through the imagination, and suddenly these animals started showing up. A bear out of my heart, an eagle out of my forehead, and one animal out of each of the chakras. And they immediately began to heal an old injury that I had not thought of in about 40 years. In fact, I'd totally forgotten that had even happened. And they showed me, they reminded me of the injury, and then they began to heal it all on their own. And I realized that they were the therapists. I wasn't. At the time, I was in a residency in therapy for a couple of years. And I realized these animals know me better than I know myself. They know where I'm injured, and they know how to heal me. And so I was just stunned by the ease with which they took that on, and began then exploring that in my clients at the time, and it proved very, very fruitful.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what was like ripe in your life at that point that you would be, that you would be receptive to this, because it's not what you would call an actually normal experience that where most of us are tuned into.
Hardly, no. I think it had been the result of a lifelong search for my own being, and I'd pursued all kinds of different avenues, including a tremendous amount of reading and studying psychology all the way through postdoctoral work, teaching at a university. I was chairman of the psychology department, but I still didn't understand myself, so I was always searching for this self-understanding. And unfortunately, American psychology led me to pigeons and rats, but I was searching for humans, and specifically the human being that I am, and what makes this guy work. What is the foundation of who he is, and in fact, who is he to begin with? And so I'd been on that really lifelong search. I was almost 50 years old. And so I was open to all kinds of different dimensions. And I'd only recently learned about the chakras. And I was still kind of skeptical about these energy things, since I'd been trained as a good behaviorist in experimental psychology. And I was told, oh, there are these energy centers in us, And I said, well, obviously we know that there's a physical heart in there, and that produces energy. So I was very stuck to to objectivity, the way one is trained, especially in graduate school. And then suddenly these animals showed up, one out of each of my chakras, and they were totally alive. Each one was totally alive and uniquely itself. And I realized these energies are the energies of our aliveness, and they have their own dimension, and it's not a thing that can be easily conceptualized. We can't really think about it specifically as a particular pattern, because each aliveness is unique in itself. And this is what these animals showed me. Each one was uniquely who it was. And once they got together and started working as a team, then they immediately began healing me. And I realized that I had been very scattered, very split, and they started bringing me back toward my wholeness, integrating one part with another, bringing relationship in between all of the dimensions of who I am, and doing this very systematically, very kindly, very creatively and intelligently, and very systematically. They knew what needed to happen first, what needed to happen second, and so on. And I was very touched by to see eventually how deeply injured I had been as a child, because I had grown up as a normal kid, you know, in a normal family. But there were so many systematic injuries just because of the structure of my upbringing. There was no intent to injure me fundamentally, but it was just, this is the way we raise children. And there was a structure that was totally synthetic and abnormal for a living being. And so we are forced to squeeze ourselves through this structure and survive it. And this is the thing, all different kinds of capacities that we have come to the fore for our survival, and they see to it that we survive. But then there's still the aspect of coming back to our wholeness, essentially the blossoming of who we are. Survival isn't enough. And the animals, or we could say these living energies in who we are, themselves know exactly what needs to happen for us to come back home to the fullness of our own being. And they have been teaching me since I first met them 30 years ago, and they continue to teach me. And I continue to be just awed at what they know, at what they can do, and also at how they go about it. They can be brutal with us if that's what we need, but usually they're very loving and kind and funny. They're very, very humorous. And they have a quality of wholeness that we ourselves have lacked because of this sieve that we've been forced through, this, we could call it a cultural survival sieve. You know, we are forced to learn how to get along with each other. But in that sense, then we are disconnected from the authenticity of our nature and of the nature around us. So,
you know, brings up a question. Again, when you say these animals show up, I know you're not speaking metaphorically.
I'm not, no. Yeah. They actually are there. But we have to learn to look through our imagination. And we've forgotten that our imagination is a living dimension of who we are. In fact, it's a very, very deep way of knowing that we have. And we have, to a great extent, disconnected from it.
Yes.
That's not to say we're lacking in imagination, but usually the imagination that we're trained into is an imagination of creating on demand or mimicking or duplicating, rather than going in and trusting this dimension that is fundamentally alive and that we're not in control of. It is essentially in control of us, but it's always on our side. It wants what's best for us. The way I do it typically with people is I just have them focus on an area like the heart and invite an animal to come out of it. And the animal shows up, and it's kind of interesting because a lot of times they'll say, oh, there's a mouse here. I don't want a mouse in my heart. I want a lion. And I'll say to them, tell that to the mouse. He'd rather have a lion. And the mouse says, tough. Here I am. You have to deal with me. And so it kind of puts people on the spot that this is the relationship that needs to develop, not a relationship out of what they would like to have or what they would expect, but a relationship out of what is the energy that's really there.
Yeah, so you're really...
So they need to...
Oh, excuse me, you're really inviting dialogue, you know. I think of Jung's Red Book, where he had conversations with his soul over many, many years in a different form.
It is ultimately, it's ultimately more than dialogue, it's relationship.
Relationship.
And this is, this is fundamentally what we need to develop with them, is a profound relationship of respect, of listening to them, of talking frankly about what we're experiencing, and developing this relationship with this deeper dimension of who we are. Dialogue is the beginning. But relationship is ultimately what it's about.
Yeah.
A lot of times in dialogue, we have our own agenda. But this animal has its agenda also. And it wants to draw us deeper into that aliveness that it participates in, rather than, we could say, the synthetic conceptual aliveness that we've learned to participate in.
Yeah.
It's a heavy thing.
I was gonna, I'm sure over the years you've worked with many, many clients, and can you give
have.
an example of how this work has dramatically changed the life or healing of one of your clients?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
The first thing that comes to my mind is a man that I met many years ago, and in his heart there was a rat. And his first words were, "Oh, a rat, I hate rats. My father used to kill them when I was a child." And so he told the rat that. And I just have them dialogue whatever comes up for them. That's what they say. I don't interpose anything that I think should be going on. It's really just to help them communicate whatever their experience is. So I had him say that to the rat, just what he was thinking. And the rat said, "Yeah, yeah, everybody hates me. Everybody hates me." And the rat then invited him to merge into it so it could experience what it was like to be a rat. And so he did. He just let himself move into being the rat. And he said suddenly, "Oh my God, this rat is a survivor. I know that quality. That's where I've been all my life." And so he then came back out of the rat, and the rat had been very famished and skinny. And he asked the rat, "What do you need from me?" And the rat said, "I need you to feed me." And so he started feeding the rat, and little by little, this rat became a very great, big, fat rat, and he was very friendly. And this guy came to just love this rat. And so this went on for a while, and then one day, after about a year, or maybe two even, this man said to me, "You know, I need to do some work, and I don't know what it is, but I'm terrified of doing it." So I took him on a journey, and we called for a guide, and who showed up but the rat. And he had said to the rat, "What needs to happen here?" And the rat said, "Oh, just follow me." And the man said, "Oh, no, I don't want to follow you." And the rat said, "Yeah, I know you don't want to, but it's for your best to follow me." And so he started following him, and he realized that the rat was leading him to his childhood home. And the closer he got to that childhood home, the more resistance there was there. And he'd say, "No, no, I don't want to go on. I don't want to go on." And I'd say, "Then just tell the rat that." And so he'd say to the rat, "I don't want to go any further here." And the rat would say, "Yeah, I know it's difficult, isn't it? You really don't want to, but you know what's best for you." And so he, little by little, he brought him there. It took a couple of hours to get him to the house. And then there was a corner they were to go around, and his resistance was tremendously strong. And all I have them do is communicate, to whoever is there guiding them. And he said to the rat, "I really don't want to go around this corner." And the rat said, "Yes, but this is the final step." And so he took him around the corner, and this man just started crying, just deeply sobbing. And I said to him, "What's happening?" And he said, "There's a dead baby." And I said, "Ask the rat what you should do with this dead baby." And he said, "The rat says to pick him up and hold him." So he picked up the dead baby and held him in his arms, and then I said, "Ask the rat what else needs to happen here." And so he did, and he said, "The rat says I need to breathe new life into this baby." And so he started doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation with this dead baby, and the baby came back to life. And he recognized this was him, a part of him that had died long, long ago in infancy. It was now coming back to life. And so he was just deeply joyful, and he gained weight. He'd been very thin before that. He had been a constant smoker. He stopped smoking. He stopped drinking, and he started just being, living and enjoying his life. And he tells me every time I talk to him, he says to me, "Steve, you saved my life." And I say to him, "No, I didn't save your life. The rat did," which is the truth. I wouldn't have known how to do that, but the rat did.
Yeah, not many people could say that. but it's an amazing story. And I mean, it's more than just story. It's just this whole healing process.
It was a beautiful event.
Yeah, in that inner journey. What do you think attracts people to your work?
I think we're all longing for who we are.
Yeah.
I think we've been divorced very early from who we are, and we've been trained so systematically to give ourselves to words and language rather than relishing and embracing the deep dimension of our own aliveness. which is much deeper than the language we've learned to speak or than the culture that we live in.
Yeah. You know, I noticed in your books the absence of the word shamanic. And could you comment that on that a little bit? Because some of the, you know, in my understanding of shamanic works, I see some similarities, but, you know, and you're inviting people to find their own authority, not, you know. And I was just wondering, in terms of healing, how, what your thoughts about shamanic work is in relationship to the work you do.
I think ultimately everybody is a shaman, and that is that the knowing in the depth of their imagination is there available to them. But we have to go on the quest to come back in touch with it and to regather it and to learn from these animals. They want us to learn their language, the language of the imagination rather than the language that we speak. A lot of times they won't speak to us in our own language, but they do things and they take us places, and we start realizing, this is the way an animal learns, you know, by watching, by doing, by reacting, rather than by trying to conceptualize and put everything into words. I think, you know, there is a great popularity of shamanism now. To me, one of the difficulties is, at least from what little I know about shamanism, I don't know very much about it, is that the shaman tends to do the work for the client. And so a kind of dependency is involved there. And for me, what we're after is independence. That is, we want to be our own person to such an extent that we don't need to go to someone else and say, please heal me, or please, you know, show me who I am. That's a journey we have to go on individually. Each person.
Yes. I noticed in your books, you have one book that is quite different, and called Little Ed and the Golden Bear. And what called
my
you?
My favorite book.
What?
That's my favorite book.
Yeah, actually, I just finished reading it last week. And what called you to write that in that format? Because it's like a parable in some sense.
It is like a parable. It's a very interesting thing. There was a contest on years ago. For $500,000, whoever would write the book that was the most positive, forward-looking for the future. And so I sat down to kind of put in, it was a novel, not just a book, but a novel. So I sat down and tried to put into some kind of novel form the work that I do, and this book just kind of emerged. As a matter of fact, I was quite surprised to see what I was writing. It was like new to me, a surprise to me, what this little guy went through and what happened to him and all of these adventures that he had in his search for himself. And it was like an opening for me, or a discovery that the writing itself knew what needed to be said. It wasn't for me to translate it or anything, but just to act as kind of the amanuensis and write down whatever I saw going on with this little guy. Every time I read that book, and I've read it 10 or 12 times after writing it, every time I read it, there's a particular place where I just start crying. Mm. And it touches me very, very deeply. And it's the place where he, you know, he burns down his school, and then he goes to, they put him in prison for this, the old fellow that he meets. And they put him in prison for this, and in prison, he meets his guide. He meets the guide that introduces him to the inner dimension of who he is. And he says at one point, he says, you know, maybe I had to come to prison to meet the fellow I needed to meet. And so there's, I think, a whole dimension in there of we are led, we are guided, and we need to be open to the learning and to the growing that we all seek, that we all search for, and we can meet at any place. It can happen anywhere, any step along the way. And that's part of our alertness. We need to be really aware. I was in Germany recently, and a friend loaned me her apartment. It was a lovely apartment. She was off with her boyfriend. And I stayed there for 2 weeks, and it was an apartment that opened up on a meadow. There was a balcony, and the balcony opened up to a meadow, and I'd go sit on the balcony every morning and have coffee. And then the Alps were right behind the meadow. And there was a cat that would come and just sit in the middle of the meadow, totally still, but you could feel its awareness filling the entire meadow. It was completely aware. And what it was doing was hunting. But it was hunting in complete stillness, in complete awareness, and anything at all that moved in that meadow, it was right there with it. And it didn't have an objective. That is, it didn't have, say, I'm hunting for a mouse or for a rabbit or something like that. It just gave its entire presence to the meadow. And I think that's the kind of search that we go on, or that we need to go on, where we're just totally alert to, okay, what's going to guide me today? Okay, what's going to teach me today? Everyone that comes to work with me as a client, I understand myself, they come to teach me. It's not they come to just work with me, but I'm here to learn something from them, every one of them. And to me, that's the way we should have grown up, with a kind of awareness that just fills whatever space we're in, and we're present with it. And it's like being engulfed or invited into the awareness of the world, or the awareness of the universe that is big. I mean, it is very big. Ours is big also, but when ours joins the awareness of the universe, it's like a coming home. It's like a stepping into a dimension that we only imagined existed, rather than one that is truly there, really available, I think, to every single person. But we've been led away from the dimension that we need to enter into in order to be there in that place.
Yeah, this kind of leads to a couple other questions that are probably related. You started this work, what, about 30 years ago? Or?
Yes, around that.
And so after doing this work for 30 years, how your relationship to this work has evolved and changed you from looking at where you were 30 years ago and where you are today. Any good nuggets there you want to share? Or?
It has changed me totally. It really has guided me. I was amazed, first of all, to find out how many injuries there were there. And I couldn't see them initially because it would have been overwhelming. And it was only when over half of them were healed that I looked back and realized, oh my God, I've been a deeply injured person. And then from then on, it's like it was downhill. That is, the going was easy. And I recognized any time something comes up, like, let's say, suddenly terror overtakes me, I recognize that as a doorway. Oh, here's some place I need to heal. Here's a place I need to grow. So it's like the things that I would have at one time walked away from or run away from now become invitations into a dimension of myself that I've been avoiding. And so the whole world shifts, and we start seeing that, there are doorways all over the place inviting us, saying, hey, come this way. This is where your growing will happen. But the important thing is to know how to choose. And usually we choose to be automatic. That is, somebody does something crappy to us, and we respond in a similar crappy way, rather than saying, I'll use this person's crappy energy to grow. I'll use it for my own growing. And that way we can take that energy and let it focus in a different direction, which is a positive direction. And since I started this work, I've had two children who have died in infancy for different reasons, both tremendously painful. And I've recognized, okay, here is this experience, here's this pain. How can I grow from it? And I would just ask the universe, can you grow me from this energy that I'm feeling here? And then there's all kinds of guidance around to grow. And a lot of times, well, several times, these children came to me in my imagination. And it was quite beautiful. And they said, look, we didn't grab a hold of anything while we were there. There was nothing to cling to. And if you look closely, our going was as easy as our birth. And that's the way it should be for you as well, to where you come into this world and you don't grasp anything. You don't cling to anything. And when it's time to go, you just go easily without trying to hang on to anything. It's a beautiful, deep, loving experience.
Yes. It seems somehow the painful events in my life, that's where there's more opportunity for growth, whether it's in, you know, loss of relationship or... I have a daughter who's a heroin addict, and she's been one of my fiercest teachers. over the years. So, and it's and you know, I think of Stephen Levine, of these unattended sorrows that we carry with us all the time, and it seems like this process allows you to attend to them, or as Michael Mead would say, running into the roar sometimes.
Yes, exactly. But we can run all the way through it to where we come out on the other side.
Yes.
And it's not in front of us, and it's no longer painful. Yeah. It's just there as a fact of our the experience of our walking through life.
Now with this work, you know, how does this work, you know, transcend the personal? Because there's a lot of personal growth here, and offer healing at maybe a larger scale, ecological or global or whatever you might want to call it.
I think, first of all, the healing needs to happen individually. You know, we each need to heal, we each need to grow, and we can't really do that on a global scale. We just have to attend to it individually. I have to do my own growing, and I can't grow someone else. I can be available to them while they grow, and I can help them develop a kind of communication which will enhance their growing, but the growing has to be theirs. There's no way I can do it for them. And so, and I think this is the way also we come home to the uniqueness of our own being, and we recognize there is no template for being human. Each one of us carries the dimension within us of how to be human uniquely so in our own way. And if we believe at all in evolution, you know, we should grow further and other than our parents. We have to be different from them or evolution stops. And one of the things parents do is they try to teach us to be like them, which is like putting a block in the face of evolution. So I think it's necessary to come to the place of recognizing the uniqueness of who one is, each person, every person. And once we start really seeing that, then the world itself changes. We see that there's no such thing as conceptual classification. You know, that
yes.
Each person is unique and creative in their own being, and this is quite beautiful. And then each person is respected for who they are, and they don't need to be competitive or compare themselves with another person or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, I agree.
And we've lost that. Yeah. We've lost that. We, you know, we lump ourselves together as Americans, for example, or as Europeans, or, you know, Germans or Swiss or whatever. But there's a deeper dimension in us. And once a person starts doing this work, they start recognizing, oh, there's a depth of aliveness and of humanity and of being, not only with other people, but also with other animals and with trees and with the earth. And so we grow naturally into a place of living from a deeper place. And I think this is what the world has lacked, you know. We've all been schooled to kind of be a social being, and that's only one level. And we need the deeper levels as well in order to be truly anchored in the aliveness that is the great gift that we've been given.
Yeah, this kind of ties in with your four ways of knowing that you talk about, the thinking, sensing, feeling, and imagery. And as you mentioned, in our culture, it seems we're not even that good at thinking, but that's where a lot of the emphasis is. And imagination is almost, at least in my schooling, it was punished. And I wonder how we might, you know, encourage that imaginal world more. So it seems to break through in the arts all the time, but in schooling and the workplace, it seems to be stifled.
And you can see what we do with the arts in school. You know, we denigrate them to the lowest dimension, and they become optional rather than an essential part of our own growing. So I think the thing is, we learn to imitate other people's thinking. In fact, we're taught to do that, rather than really honoring the development of our own thinking, letting it be nurtured and letting it grow into its own constellation. And so thinking never develops. Thinking becomes repetitive. And we learn to repeat what we've read. You know, and tests are nothing but repetition. And so school is kind of horrifying because it is so limiting, and it misdirects part of who we are. It misdirects our thinking. We don't really learn to think. We learn to repeat and to imitate. And once we start growing inside, our thinking becomes our own. It doesn't belong. It isn't something we can repeat, but it isn't the way our thinking works. You know, our thinking is supposed to reach deep inside of who we are and come home to that place of the imagination and say to it, hello, good to have you here. Wow, I thought I had to do all of the work here myself, taking care of this guy and seeing that he survives his way through school. I didn't realize I had this other help here. Good to recognize that, you know. And then it joins the other dimensions of who we are, and they form a constellation of wholeness where they're not separate, where sensing isn't separate from thinking, and thinking isn't separate from feeling, and feeling isn't separate from the imagination. They all work together the way they did when we were born, when we were infants. There was no separation. We learned that.
How would you envision, you know, I'm thinking, you know, we, as a parent, you have a child, and you, when they're very young, you try to preserve their innocence, and then off they go to school. Well, could, you know, using your imagination and what you know, how would you see that change, or what kind of alternative structure would need to be in place to really foster that type of growth and maturity?
I think, first of all, the parents need to grow.
Yeah.
So that they can really provide a wholesome place for that child in trust, because the child needs to be trusted and asked and communicated with, not just ordered around, you know. Too much of the communication between parent and child becomes a sense of ordering it around as if it were a servant or as if it's supposed to obey automatically, rather than it, the child being a friend. And, yeah, I had that same trouble with my daughter, who's grown up to be a beautiful, strong individual. And we sent her to a very good school, which in Santa Fe was a magnet school, where they had one creative project, and then everything that they were to learn along the way was connected in some way to the artistic project that was the foundation for it. It was a lovely orientation, and it was the best thing for her. She got a little bit out of sorts when she went to high school, because high school is so cliquish and so on, but she still retained her own ability to think for herself. And I'm sorry, she's never, well, she's gone to college here and there, but never really with any kind of a deep commitment. And right now she's in a committed relationship. In fact, she lives in Oregon, in Bedford, Oregon.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking here what to ask you next. I could talk to you for a long time, but I'm a little bit sensitive to the time here. You offer a workshop you did last year, and I think you're doing it again this year, called The Vessel and the Voice.
Yes, in fact, it just ended a week ago.
Yeah, okay. And it includes, besides the deep imagery that you offer, it also includes the making of a micaceous clay pot and a drum by two, I think, was it Navajo?
No, they're Apaches.
Or Apaches.
Apache brothers that live in a little village about an hour away from where I live. And the one, Felipe Ortega, is a renowned potter and makes beautiful pots that are very highly prized here. And he's been doing workshops for many years. And when people come to him for a workshop, he says, I'm not going to teach you to make art. In the Apache language, there is no word art. What you were going to make here is a bean pot that you can cook beans in. But these bean pots are beautiful that they make. They're made out of micaceous clay, which heats evenly throughout the pot. And also the clay itself has, what do you call it? It's not a, it's the opposite of acidic. And it cooks the, whatever it's cooking.
Alkaline, probably.
Yes, alkaline. And he's a magnificent potter and really a great teacher and a shaman himself, although he won't call himself that. And so he teaches the pottery, and then his brother Jimmy Ortega teaches drum making and makes beautiful drums. And we pin it together with the imagery work in the sense that every person is a pot. Every person is a container. And the question is, what do you contain? What were you made to contain? Are you empty enough to contain that, you know? Or are you too full of things other people have put in there? And so we work along those lines, and also along the lines of the clay that you're made from, that came from the earth, of recognizing this clay and the beauty of it. And then there's also the matter of the voice, which is people are here to express something, not necessarily through the voice, but maybe through action, or through creativity or something like that. And this expression is similar to the rhythm of the drum. And so they make these two things. One is the vessel that is who they are. It's there to carry something, and the other is the drum that's here to speak and to announce something in or to the world. And so we combine all of those in that way, tying them together through the imagination by asking particular questions, or by meeting with the spirit of the pot, or by meeting with the spirit of the drum. And so it's quite a powerful and a very beautiful workshop that we do. And the two brothers, the two Apache brothers, are just masters of their craft.
Yeah, well, we'll
my wife cooks throughout the ordeal, and she's an excellent cook. She's from Ireland, and she just cooks beautifully.
And where is this located?
It's in New Mexico. It starts out at our home, which is called River Spirit. It's a place right on the Rio Grande River where there are a number of animals. There's a beaver family in there. There's a golden eagle that stops by occasionally. There's some raccoons that come by and squabble. And there are a lot of different animals here. And it starts out here, and then we drive to La Madera, which is about an hour away, kind of up in the hills. And that's where Felipe lives, in the house that his grandparents built. He has his studio right there. And people stay with him then for the next 4 or 5 days while they're making pots and making the drum. Jimmy lives right nearby, and Jimmy has a studio there called Apache Drums. And, yeah. And then I go out and work with them with the imagery the whole time. It's a very, very full time for them, but they end up with some beautiful pieces. Really fine pieces.
And people, if they want to find more out about it, they can go to, I think, www.thevesselandthevoice.com, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
They can, or to my website also, which is esgallegos.com.
Okay, great. Yeah, and we'll when we do our publication, we'll put those links in there, too.
Thank you very much, Werner.
Yeah. Well, anyway, I want to thank you so much again for taking the time to allow me to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Werner. I appreciate you getting in touch with me and spending time with you like this. I look forward to meeting you personally.
Yeah, we'll hopefully maybe see you sometime at Brighton Bush.
Okay, we'll work toward it.